From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Today, budget talks and the debate on how to raise the money to fix the roads.
We've agreed to table that discussion at the moment and move forward with the budget that will keep state government moving and open.
The governor is not yet on board with that agreement. We'll look at the trend of rectangular, wood-framed, multi-story apartment buildings that sometimes have huge splashes of color or other things to set them apart.
The architect's job then becomes to put the wrapper on the box.
I'll talk with the author of a book on sculptures adorning Detroit buildings.
Why is there a goat on a bank? What does that have to do with anything? And they're actually symbols of cautious financial dealings.
And it's pawpaw season. The fruit inspires a cocktail. All of that and more coming up after this news update. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. The budget is the big news at the state capitol this week. The Republican-led House and Senate have proposed $500 million in additional spending for the roads. The Republican budget plan calls for a 0.5% increase for universities and a 0.8% increase for community colleges. The rate of inflation is just below 2%. Gongwer News reports the budget would also cut the Department of Natural Resources by 9%. Joining us now is the chair of the House Appropriations Committee, Representative Shane Hernandez. Good to talk with you again.
Happy to be joining you.
Well, let's start with the roads. The governor, Gretchen Whitmer, says we need an additional $2 billion each year to fix the roads. Governor Snyder, when he was governor, said we needed a similar increase. So why is your budget only increasing spending on the roads by $500 million?
Well, I don't believe that anybody disagrees that we need to have a long-term road solution. I think both Republicans and the governor have both said that. We've agreed to table that discussion at the moment and move forward with the budget that will keep state government moving and open. But we don't think that it is responsible to not continue to invest in roads just through the regular budget process. You can look at past budgets, and Republicans have been investing in roads above and beyond what is required by law for several years now.
Well, this $500 million is coming out of the general fund. Was that extra money? Did you have to trim something to find that money?
Well, we've done it in the past. It's through efficient budgeting processes that we're able to continue to invest in our roads. I think the people of Michigan see our roads as one of the number one issues in the state. And I think when you're looking at a core function like infrastructure and roads, I don't see why we wouldn't use general fund dollars to invest.
I'm sure, as you're aware, the Democrats are saying, look, if they pass this $500 million, they're going to say enough's enough, and they're not even going to talk about a long-term plan. What's your response to that?
There's been an agreement from the leaders and the governor to continue those talks, and I think many of our members want to continue those talks. As the speaker and I have said since the very beginning of this conversation, we both believe that the sales tax shift at the pump needs to happen, and that's part of a long-term conversation. We're dropping that at the moment. We want to engage in that conversation. It's something that both of us and many in our caucus want to see, and I think the people across the state of Michigan believe that every penny that they pay at the pump should go to transportation and roads. And so we have just as much interest in continuing the conversation as the governor does.
Governor Whitmer did not say so specifically this week, but she's talked about a veto in the past. You're sending a budget that might mean a veto and then possibly a government shutdown unless you can find a compromise by the end of the month. What's the strategy behind that?
We understand, and she's told us that she could veto the budget, but we also believe that it's important for us at this point in time to put a budget out there that funds our roads, funds our schools at a record level, funds water quality, and keeps the government open. That we need to continue driving this conversation forward, and at this point, we think it is our job to push forward with a budget that does those things.
Let's switch to higher ed for a moment. As I mentioned, the rate of inflation is just under 2% right now. The increases for community colleges and universities combined is less than 1%. Effectively, that's a cut. Why?
Well, I don't know how less than 1% is a cut, but you know, we're definitely open to continuing to have these conversations. Unfortunately, we aren't having those conversations with the governor's office at this point. But the way we look at it, this is our what we're willing to start with. And when they're willing to come to the table, we'll continue having conversations about investing in all areas of state government.
Why does your budget cut the Department of Natural Resources by 9%?
Well, I believe if you got into the details of it, you'd see that there's some shifts from statutory and federal funding and general funding. So Some of that is our fund shifts. Some of it are using fund balances that have been there. Instead of giving them general fund money, if they're sitting on balances, we want them to use those balances before we give them general fund money. So I think some of that, just looking strictly at the numbers, isn't what we should be doing. We should be looking at, are we funding the programs that are necessary? And I believe our budget does that.
Are you saying the department will not lose money? They'll have the same amount of money at their disposal as they did the last fiscal year?
I'm saying that Republicans see our natural resources as something that's very important, and we believe that we're funding the Department of Natural Resources at a necessary level.
You've made some increases in other areas, such as water cleanup.
Yeah, the governor had come out of the gate asking for $120 million in water quality funding in Michigan. The Senate had passed a Senate budget including that. The House did not include it, but it was definitely a discussion we all wanted to continue, and the budgets that we passed yesterday do include that $120 million for water quality. We think that we have some very important issues in Michigan, one of them being PFAS, and $40 million of this $120 million will go towards PFAS.
Representative Shane Hernandez is the chair of the House Appropriations Committee. Thanks for taking the time to talk to us today.
Thank you.
Let's now turn to Governor Gretchen Whitmer. Welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you, Lester.
Representative Hernandez says the $500 million for roads added to the budget does not preclude a long-term road funding deal. What do you think of this last-minute addition to the budget?
Well, it flies in the face of our agreement that we're going to take roads out of the budget conversation. And one-time dollars, unfortunately, don't go a whole long way. This is an ongoing problem we have that costs $2.5 billion. And so when the legislature puts one-time money in to that extent, it means it's overtime and planning. It's trying to hustle to get projects ready to go. And it's about the worst way that you can go about doing it. I'm glad the legislature is talking about long-term funding after we get through this budget. But these one-time dollars could be put to use in a lot of other ways that could be really meaningful, like putting hydration stations in our kids' schools, by building out and giving communities dollars for infrastructure to replace the water infrastructure, bringing it into our homes. There are a lot of things that will be unfunded because of this kind of last-minute effort to shoehorn a few extra dollars into transportation.
Will you veto this budget with this one-time $500 million for roads?
Well, we'll see what the budget looks like when it gets to me. They haven't voted on it in conference committee yet, so I'm not able to give you a thoughtful answer.
Governor, do you think the Republicans are testing you, testing your resolve?
Well, I think that this is the consequence of, you know, winning an election on the issues like the fundamentals that I did last year. It was a historic election. 2 million people voted for me. And I think this is what it is coming down to. We have a legislature that is still very much gerrymandered and not reflective of the people they're supposed to be represented, and remains to be seen if we will ever get to a real road funding solution. I put one on the table 6 months ago. The legislature took an extended summer vacation, came back, pushed this off to the last minute, and now they're cobbling together budgets without even negotiating with me. So I think that this shows the exact problem we have due to gerrymandering and term limits. And I think that it's going to be a struggle to see kind of where we're headed as soon as this budget's over.
Zach Gorchow and his colleague John Lindstrom wrote blogs for Gongware News Service. Both came up with options such as line item vetoes for Republican priorities if they follow through with this, or passing the budget and then going to the state administrative board to transfer funds from one program to another within a department, or veto the budget and end up with a state government shutdown. What are the options you're considering?
I think those are all very real possibilities, but the fact of the matter is, I've been committed to avoiding a shutdown, and that's why I introduced the budget and worked so hard to get the legislature to come back to town this summer so that we could have real negotiations. They chose not to. They put us in this position, and so it remains to be seen what is actually going to end up in these budgets that land on my desk, but I am fully aware of all the different mechanisms I have to respond to them, and I'm prepared to use them.
I want to talk about higher ed for a second. As I mentioned to Representative Hernandez, the current rate of inflation is just under 2%. The increase to community colleges and universities is under 1%. In effect, that's a cut. What do you think of that?
I think it's a cut, too. The budget that I proposed made a 3% investment in community colleges and higher education. We have a huge skills gap in Michigan. 45% of our adults have the skills they need to get into high-wage jobs. We've got to get that number to 60%. And the way to do it is by opening up paths for people to get the skills they need. higher education, community college. These are critical pieces of hitting that goal and raising incomes for folks in Michigan. And the fact that the legislature is now looking at under 1% increase, I think compromises our ability to compete and ability to meet the skills needs of businesses in Michigan now and those we're hoping will make Michigan their home.
The Republican budget also includes a 9% cut to the Department of Natural Resources, but Republicans maintain the DNR has fund balances that will sustain it. What do you think of that cut?
Well, I think that, you know, that could very well jeopardize some really important things that we're trying to do in DNR. You know, DNR has a really important role in conservation and protection of our natural resources. It's got an important role when it comes to fish hatcheries and our outdoor recreation. We have a huge economy built up around outdoor recreation. In fact, this week I announced Michigan was the first state ever to create an outdoor recreation office to harness these great resources. And so when you see the legislature do across the board cuts like this, it says that they don't value any of these things. And I think that that's a problem.
I want to go back to the roads just for a moment. Will you insist on a 45-cent gas tax, or is there some flexibility there?
From the day I introduced the budget, I maintain I believe this is the best way to do it. It is constitutionally protected, so the dollars go into roads and bridges, and no future legislature can play the shell games that have become of our state budget. But I've also said I recognize that there is another legitimate thought about how we go about meeting this need. I am eager to have that conversation. The fact of the matter is the legislature's never been really serious about solving this problem. The only solution they put on the table is taking money out of teachers' pension system. That is a terrible idea, and it's something that I said was a non-starter, and yet that's the only thing they've come up with to date. If someone comes to the table with an alternative way to meet our infrastructure needs, I am all ears.
What's the next step to getting a budget for the state?
So the legislature will keep negotiating with themselves and send me the budgets. I hope that they send them before they go up to Mackinac Island for their big party with the Trump administration next weekend. And so that gives me enough time to really scrutinize the budgets and make decisions about how I'm going to respond to them. But if they wait and send them to me at the last minute and play games like that, it puts everything into jeopardy. And it remains to be seen. I've done my job. It's on the legislature to do theirs.
Gretchen Whitmer is the governor of the state of Michigan. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
After the break, decorative figures adorn the buildings of Detroit, gargoyles, griffins, even goats. We talked to the author of a book that documents the silent statues watching over the Motor City. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. In Detroit, silent guardians watch over the city. Many people never even notice them as they keep vigil. But one book exposes them, studies them, presents them, and explains them. This book is Guardians of Detroit, Architectural Sculpture in the Motor City. The author is Jeff Morrison, and I had a chance to speak with him earlier this year. So schools and churches and firehouses, municipal buildings, office buildings, Beaux-Arts, Gothic, Art Deco, statues of historic figures, mythical creatures, gargoyles, and grotesques of all kinds. I mean, there are so many sculpted images all over the city. When did you start noticing them?
Well, I had first taken some pictures about 10 or 15 years ago. I had actually gone to a dog show at Cobo Hall and walked past some of the buildings, and I thought they were pretty striking, and then came down one day with a friend of mine just to walk around and take some pictures. And then about fall of 2015, I was going through some old photos and came across those, and I thought, well, maybe I should try to do something with these.
Yeah, I was going to say, how that appreciation evolved into, you know, I think I ought to do a book.
I had time on my hands. I had recently lost my job and was looking for a new job, hadn't found one, was organizing the photos and thought, well, if I can't find a job, I'll have to make my own job, and decided to start working on this project. And as I mentioned in the preface, I thought maybe I'd get 100 pages. I didn't have any idea how much there was. And as I got down there and started taking pictures of buildings I knew, I would find more buildings along the way.
And you were talking about starting out thinking you'd do the whole metro area, and you ended up just sticking to the city because
exactly.
There's so much there.
Exactly.
Before we get into details about the figures, you photographed a lot of these sculptures, and a lot of them were several floors up, such as the sculptures on Book Tower, 13 floors up. How did you get those shots?
Well, I'm using a high-resolution camera. It's like a 24-megapixel camera. And then I'm also using a 600-millimeter zoom lens. And I'll usually snap two or three shots at a time with the automatic shutter and hope that I got what I need. And I came back to buildings several times, different times a day. It's always a matter of what the light is like. And when you first go to a building, you take some pictures and then you think, well, I need to come back at this time or that time and try to get better light on this area.
All right, for the camera buffs, I got to ask, Canon, Nikon, something else?
Canon, 5D yeah. Mark III.
The Griffin is an often used figure in all of these architectural styles. Why is that a favorite?
I'm not sure entirely. Griffins are guardians of treasure. The Griffin is also the name of the first ship to sail across Lake Erie, one of the first commercial vessels on the lake. It was Robert de La Salle's ship. And I think that might be part of it. But you see it a lot on police stations, which it must just have been thought of as a symbol of Detroit.
I've never quite understood the faces that you see on churches of a certain period. What was the reason for some of these really ugly and grotesque faces and figures? Because I don't make a direct connection between them and Christianity.
There's a couple of things. The main thing is that, especially when you see the gargoyles, say on Trinity Episcopal Church, one of the first buildings featured in the book, you see the gargoyles and they extend out and they look like they're trying to get away from the building. So symbolically, they're showing evil spirits or demons that might want to come in. There's no place for them here. They don't like it here. They're leaving. Why would they try to get, you know, these other ones coming up, try to get in?
So I always thought of gargoyles as guardians, but in this case, they're not. They're the opposite of, they're trying to get away from the building. We know a lot of the architects of Detroit. We don't know many of these sculptors. You did track down some of them. How much did you learn about them?
One of the things that I found really interesting about them was how interconnected they are. You start with like Julius Melchers, who's considered the father of architectural sculpture in Detroit, one of the city's first art teachers. He taught art to Albert Kahn, among others. And then you see the people that worked with him or learned from him, they taught others. And they're working on different buildings. And then you see others, like Thomas Wagner had students that worked under him and learned from him. And you see the interconnections all the way along.
You know, if you're only casually familiar with Detroit, a lot of people are going to think about the Guardian Building, and a lot of people love that building. What's your assessment of that building and its sculpted imagery? Because it's Art Deco and a little different than a lot of the other buildings in town.
Well, the Guardian Building is exciting because of its use of color, for one thing. The bricks on the building were specially formulated for that building, and it's the largest brick-clad building in the world even today. But the sculpture on it, I think it's exciting. It's Corrado Parducci's work. I have in the book a rendering from the architectural firm, and you can see the variation between what they talked about doing or what they wanted or proposed and what Corrado Parducci ended up doing. One of the ways he worked and one of the reasons he was so prolific and worked on so many buildings in the Detroit area was that the architects trusted him. Back in the old days, late 1800s, early 1900s, somebody at the architectural firm would do a very detailed scale drawing of the type of sculpture they wanted on the building, and it was up to a craftsman to follow that. And as things progressed, all the architects of the city had such faith in him that they would do rougher sketches and just let him finish it up. As a matter of fact, sometimes Kahn on his blueprints has just an indication and it says Parducci.
So he became a collaborator instead of just a contractor.
Exactly, exactly.
I want to talk about the Old County Building sculptures. They've always caught my attention. Can you talk about the symbolism of those sculptures on top of the building?
Well, you have the four sculptures at the very top of the tower that symbolize law and commerce, mechanics, I think, and can't remember what the last one is off of my head.
It's only one of hundreds of buildings you've been looking at.
But yeah. And they're very interesting. Then you have the larger ones at the base of the tower. And they're all interesting, one reason because of the technique, the way in which they were built. They're copper sheeting over an iron frame. And as a matter of fact, during World War II, the county treasurer proposed taking all these statues down off the building and melting them down for the war effort because he thought they were solid bronze.
Mm.
And there was a lot of uproar by preservationists, but when they found out that they were just copper over an iron frame and there wasn't that much material to be had, the statues were saved.
Yeah, I know of a lot of courthouses around the nation that lost their wrought iron fencing or things like that for the war effort at that time. in a lot of these sculptures, there's this kind of medieval atmosphere. Is this American architects trying to imitate the vintage of European buildings, or is there some other driving force behind that?
It's a little of both. When you look at Trinity Episcopal, that's very overtly designed to look like a 13th century church. Architects were sent to study Gothic churches in southern England and to bring back the best of those and sketches of the sculpture on those and to create something that looked like it was out of the 13th century. But then you get into some of the newer churches like the Cathedral of the Most Blessed Sacrament, and it's kind of a Gothic revival. And it has a Gothic feel to it, but with a more modern feel. So it's more neo-Gothic, new Gothic. And you see the overtones of Art Deco styling in this and a little more modern styling to it. And most of these architects and most of these sculptors, they studied in Europe. They went to Europe and toured Europe and learned from the buildings of Europe and then brought what they learned back here.
There are eagles and pelicans, owls and snakes, wolves and crows. Animal imagery is very common. Do these symbols have specific meanings, or do they change over time?
They have specific meanings to their time. You mentioned the pelicans. That's one of the things that got me started, because Metropolitan United Methodist is right along Woodward Avenue, and I would pass it, and there's a large pelican on a church. And I would look at that and wonder, why is there a pelican on a church? And it's actually a symbol of atonement. The ancient naturalists believed that a pelican would actually kill its young because the noise that they were making bothered him. But then 3 days later, he would tear open his breast and feed them with his own blood to bring them back to life. So that's a pretty obvious Christian symbol. Another one that's very interesting that you didn't mention is the goat that you see on Bankers Trust Company. You look at a goat by the door, and why? Why is there a goat on a bank? What does that have to do with anything? And they're actually symbols of cautious financial dealings. And if you dream of a goat walking around a farmyard at night, that means that you're going to come into some money.
Well, I've never had that dream. That might explain a lot for me.
Yeah, I'd like to have that dream.
In the 1950s, 60s, 70s, a lot of facades covered up some of these sculptures, some of the relief work, and some of them were removed, just chiseled away or taken away. During this renaissance of Detroit, does restoration include these sculptures and reliefs?
Yeah, they're actually doing quite a good job of renewing these buildings. There seems to be a real commitment to historical preservation. That being said, there are some buildings that are going to be lost, and that's a shame, even though so many buildings are being restored, like the National Theater is scheduled to be torn down. But even then, it's kind of a good news, bad news thing. That's the oldest theater in Detroit.
A Kahn building, yeah.
Yeah, his only Kahn-designed theater. But they're going to save the front facade and use it as a gateway to a pedestrian park.
Well, I suppose that's something. I'd hate to see that thing completely disappear. It looks like it was once very beautiful. You mentioned how some of these figures have deteriorated badly, some because of using coal for heat caused acidity in the air and ate away some of the stone. Some of it's just weathering. How much have we lost just due to that?
A lot. You look at the sculptures on Trinity Episcopal Church, they're mostly still there. Some are damaged. There's one of a wolf in priest clothing, a symbol of the worldliness of the church and a warning against that. And the snout of the wolf is broken off, and that's kind of disappointing. And then on the book building, they had to replace the nude figures holding up the cornice. They had become so damaged that they couldn't be repaired. They had to be replaced with fiberglass figures, mm-hmm. fiberglass imitations, which, to be fair, 13 stories above ground, you're not going to know.
One of the most celebrated of Detroit's sculptures and carvings might be the Scott Fountain at Belle Isle. Why do you think it's so popular?
I think it's just a beautiful fountain, for one thing. It's just great to look at in the summer. They have the lights on it at night. There's a lot of stories about James Scott, how he was not a very popular guy.
That's what I understand. Yeah.
He left money to build the fountain on the condition that they build a statue of him. And there was a lot of debate about whether someone should be able to buy a memorial to themselves, especially someone that many people considered to be of low character.
We stopped seeing this kind of imagery being incorporated in much of the architecture in the last half of the 20th century and this century. What do you think of that?
I think it's a disappointment. I understand the movement. I understand the principles behind more modern architecture. But I think where that trend is being reversed, and I like to see it as a sports fan, is in sports stadiums, particularly Comerica Park.
you know, all the Tigers as part of that. Or if you go to Toronto, their stadium, they have sculpture on the outside of it. And it's just nice to see that coming back.
I hate to ask this question, especially about a book that's this extensive, but do you have a favorite Detroit building or structure or image?
Well, when I was working on the book, people would ask me that question, and the answer was usually the next one, because I'd right. find a building and start shooting pictures and start doing research, and I would get very involved and into it. I think there's a couple. A Guardian building is an obvious choice, the Fisher, but I think the building that most epitomizes architectural sculpture for me and what I think of as architectural sculpture is Trinity Episcopal Church. The picture on the cover of the book is from that church. There's originally 172 sculptures planned to be on the outside of that building. They didn't quite get to that many for reasons that are explained in the book. And just when I think of architectural sculpture, I think of Gothic architecture, and I think of something like that.
The book is Guardians of Detroit, Architectural Sculpture and the Motor City. The book is rich in photos, details, and history. The author is Jeff Morrison. Congratulations. Nicely done.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you for having me here today. I really appreciate it.
Pawpaw is sometimes known as the Michigan banana. It's the only native tropical fruit in North America. And as it turns out, it makes for a pretty great cocktail.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Hi, Tammy.
Hi, Lester.
That's Tammy Coxon of Tammy's Tastings, and we're here for another Cheers episode. And I'm very proud of you because a couple of my colleagues, April Van Buren and Mercedes Mejia, challenged you with making a sort of pina colada, but not using pineapple, instead using pawpaw. And I love that because, you know, it's the Midwest tropical fruit. So why accept that challenge?
I thought it was a great challenge. As soon as I heard the words pawpaw colada, I thought this is a drink that needs to get made.
How difficult is it to make a transition from, you know, a classic standard sugary drink that people love, or at least some people love, and making it out of a fruit that not very many people are familiar with?
Well, pawpaws are very, very sweet, so the sugary side wasn't a problem at all. One of the things that I had to decide first off was I going to replace one of the standard pina colada ingredients with the pawpaw, or was I going to use it as an add-on? In the end, I thought it didn't really work as a drink if it didn't have some of that pineapple juice in there. So this has both pineapple juice and some pawpaw puree.
So not everybody's familiar with pawpaw. What do we know about it?
So it is a native North American fruit, grows up here in the Great Lakes all the way down to the Florida Panhandle, and it doesn't taste like what you would think a North American fruit would taste like. It actually tastes really tropical. Sometimes it's been called a Michigan banana because it has this interesting soft texture. Some people actually call it a custard apple. And then it has mango notes, banana notes, some sort of funky, musky kind of flavors. It's really unique, very sweet, but totally a taste of Michigan.
And one of the things that's really interesting about pawpaws is if you get a fairly green, fresh pawpaw versus one that's fully ripe, the taste is much different. And some people prefer it one way, some people prefer it the other way. What did you use in this pawpaw colada?
So we use very, very ripe pawpaw pulp. Unlike other ingredients where you might have to puree them in a blender, the pawpaw, when it's very ripe, is really soft. So it's just a matter of scraping off the pulp from around these big brown seeds that are in the middle of it, and then you've already got a puree that's ready to mix into a drink.
Well, how'd you make the pawpaw colada?
In a blender, I combined 1.5 ounces of rum. I used a dark rum. You could also use a white rum. I used 1 ounce of coconut syrup. So a traditional pina colada recipe calls for cream of coconut, which is a highly processed product. You may have seen it on shelves called Coco Lopez. I like to use something a little homemade, but you could totally substitute Coco Lopez in this recipe. I used 2 ounces of pineapple juice, 2 tablespoons of the pawpaw pulp, 1/4 ounce of lime, because like I said, pawpaw is really sweet, and I wanted to counter that a little bit to make a tastier drink. And then this is going to sound a little weird, but a pinch of salt really amps up all the flavors in the drink. Then I added 1 cup of crushed ice to my blender and let it rip.
So what's it taste like?
Well, you tell me, does this fit your platonic image of a pawpaw colada?
Well, the pawpaw is really present because it's got that unique taste, but it's very, very good. The rum is just a tiny back note to the whole thing, but the pineapple and the pawpaw play together really well.
You completely miss the coconut, and I think that's a really important thing that ties that pineapple and the pawpaw together and gives it that creamy texture that we expect from a pina colada.
Well, I'm glad you took up this challenge. The results are really tasty.
We've been doing these Cheers episodes for a while now, so we're always looking for new ideas.
If you want to make a suggestion, remember, it has to be a Michigan ingredient, and you can send a message through the Stateside webpage, and you can find all of that at michiganradio.org. Cheers.
Cheers.
Still to come, we'll talk about why new apartment buildings seem to look similar and almost flimsy.
It's become the default method of residential construction in the U.S.
That's next on Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. An apartment building opened up in the Corktown neighborhood of Detroit, right where Tiger Stadium used to stand. And here's the thing. This apartment building looks a lot like a lot of other apartment buildings I've seen built in the last 5 years. I mean, you can see them in Detroit, in Grand Rapids. There are a couple in Lansing, East Lansing. And I'm not the only one to notice this new architectural style. Justin Fox has too. He's a columnist at Bloomberg, and he wrote about it, and he joins us now. Welcome to the program.
Great to be talking to you.
So you write that these same kind of apartment buildings are popping up all across the nation. Describe what a typical downtown version of this type of building looks like.
It's five stories, sometimes up to seven, especially on the West Coast. It often fills up an entire block, tends to be very boxy. This really varies by region, but in a lot of places, there's a lot of use of bright colors, sometimes to sort of break up the facade, although in certain parts of the country, like in Texas and in a lot of the Midwest, although that Corktown building, I couldn't totally tell what they covered it with, but brick facades are common too. And out in the West Coast, it's always stucco, but often with bright colors. There's usually, at least if it's downtown, there's probably restaurants or other shops on the ground floor, or at least space intended for that. A lot of developers complain that they can't actually rent that space out, but the cities want them to do it.
What I see is big colored squares on a board game, or maybe it's like a scattered Rubik's Cube or something like that. Now, what do you call this architectural style?
I drove across the country last fall, and that's when I first started realizing that these things were everywhere. And I, you know, in terms of architectural style, there's a guy who called them, writing about some developments in Washington, called them fast casual, which I sort of like, but he actually was referring to a somewhat different kind of building. And when I started asking around, what it turned out to be the thing that they most have in common is actually the part that you can't see, which is that they're made of lightweight wood frames, basically the way single-family houses are.
Right. This whole new, or not new, actually, it's 150 years old, but it's a different kind of construction being used. So how does this differ from what we used to use in materials and in building style?
Well, you know, apartment buildings were usually in cities, and big cities in the U.S. and in Europe had big fires. And so over time, increasingly, they turned away from wood in construction. I mean, there have been partial bans on wood in construction in New York City, I think, since the early 1700s. And these sort of got codified on a nationwide level in the early 1900s. Apartment buildings had to be made of masonry, concrete, steel, and single-family houses were still made of wood frames. And what finally started happening around mid-century, as people were building apartment complexes, they were increasingly being built out in sort of suburban areas. They were low-slung, smaller things, so they built them with wood frames too. And over time, the housing code has changed in ways that have allowed them to build them up to 7 stories is the max.
You can't blame the developer. I mean, you can build cheaper but still charge the same rent as if you were a masonry building, right?
Right. And there's a flexibility to it. It makes it easier to string all the wires and HVAC and everything through the buildings. It's become the default method of residential construction in the U.S., so there are a lot more people who know how to do it.
Yeah, I'm just wondering if this construction is so much cheaper in materials and in labor, why haven't developers been using this sooner?
To some extent, it's fads and fashion. To some extent, it's that the building code didn't allow it, really. I mean, these taller buildings, you know, another term for them that I found as I started digging into these was 5/1, which it's both an arcane reference to parts of the building code where there's type 5 structures and type 1, but it's also just 5 stories of wood over 1 story of concrete. That was pioneered in California in the 1970s. Because of possibly inadvertent building code changes? I don't know. I mean, it's partly that as sprinklers became widely used, building code officials got comfortable with allowing wood frame buildings to get a little taller. The 3 different national, regional organizations that were in charge of building codes merged in the late 90s and created a national code, and they basically took the West Coast rules on these apartment buildings, which were more permissive than the rest of the country, and adopted them nationwide. And that became the new rule in the early 2000s. What happened after that is kind of a boom in construction in cities. I mean, Detroit is one of the most dramatic examples of that, inner city where there hadn't been new residential construction in a really long time, suddenly has a lot of it, and now there was this ability to do it in this new way.
Let's talk about the environmental impact, because wood, at least, is renewable. Manufacturing, concrete, masonry, they're big producers of carbon dioxide, which, of course, is a greenhouse gas that contributes to climate change. That would seem to be an advantage as well. Is that contributing to the popularity of this shift in how we construct apartment buildings?
I mean, it's definitely something that both the wood products industry and the housing industry have been pushing, and I think they're not making it up. I've read a lot of scientific studies that generally agree with this idea that depending on how the forests are managed, what they're replanted with after you chop down the wood to build buildings with it, that it can be much closer to carbon neutral or even carbon positive than other building materials. So, yeah, that's part of it, and it's also pushing a sort of worldwide trend towards trying to use different kind of wood construction, which is mainly lots of little pieces of wood glued together to create tall buildings. I think the tallest are now up to about 18 stories. There's one
wow.
in British Columbia, and there are a couple in Scandinavia that are built that way. But they're different. I think there's a lot of uncertainty about how long glued together wood will stay glued together, but in general, they don't have some of the other, they're less flimsy, I guess you could say, than these lightweight wood frame buildings, which is what we're getting mainly in the U.S.
So I understand that this wood is somehow made of fire resistant or fireproof, and God knows what chemical that is. Is it still, though, a risk? Because, I mean, we saw Chicago burn down because it was an all-wood building city.
Yeah, I mean, when these buildings are under construction, they're unbelievably flammable, especially out on the West Coast, but really all over. There have been tons of building fires related to these lightweight wood frame apartment buildings. Once they're built, they all have sprinkler systems in there, which is more than most single-family houses do. So in that sense, they're reasonably safe. There was still one pretty terrible fire a while back just across the river from New York in a building that had sort of a partial sprinkler system, kind of an earlier version of these, a little shorter, and that burned down. There have been changes in the building code since then. There are definitely a lot of firefighters who are worried about this. They're especially worried that, maybe 30 years down the road when some of these buildings have fallen on hard times and maybe something goes wrong with the sprinkler system, then they're total fire traps. I think once they're done, they're pretty safe.
I got one final question. I mean, this type of construction is cheaper. That does not mean they all have to look the same. How do you explain this exterior aesthetic?
development in the U.S. is increasingly financed by big institutional investors like pension funds, foundations, stuff like that. And it's still more regional than lots of industries, but it's much more national than it used to be. And I do think, I mean, you know, every city in the U.S. that built a lot of housing in the 1920s has a bunch of craftsman-style bungalows. We all think they look magnificent now, but there were people back then complaining about bungalow disease and the sameness of all the new development. So to a certain extent, every kind of new, I mean, and McMansions, they all look the same all over the country. So there's a certain kind of tendency of the building industry always to do this.
What do you think about the way they look?
I mean, I like a lot of them. They're more interesting than apartment building. Well, for one thing, in a lot of these cities where I've seen these things going up, there had been no new apartment buildings in a really long time. And, the ones from back in the 20s and 30s are pretty cool looking. But most apartments built in the 50 years after that aren't super interesting to look at. And some of these are going to look terrible in 15 years. The color's going to fade and whatever. But there are really cool looking ones. There's one in Boise that I didn't actually see on my trip, but I've seen pictures of since. It's this really creative use of the kind of freedom that this building technique allows. So I don't dislike them as much as most people do, but I will say I live in a city, New York, where there aren't any because they're still not allowed here.
Right.
So maybe it's easy for me to say. I just see them when I'm on vacation or otherwise traveling.
Justin Fox is a columnist with Bloomberg. Good talking to you.
Great being on with you.
Let's turn now to an architect who might be able to tell us more about this new apartment building aesthetic. Kit McCullough is a lecturer at the Taubman College of Architecture and Urban Planning at the University of Michigan. Kit specializes in urban design and real estate development. Welcome to the program.
Thanks.
So why do so many of these new apartment buildings look so similar?
Well, I actually teach a course at the university on real estate development for architects and planners, where we try to answer this very question. And I think a lot of it has to do with the development process. These buildings are formulas, and like most formulas, they're the most efficient response to a set of constraints. Zoning codes, building construction, safety codes, and finance all push towards the same design answer to the problem.
But how does that result in big, colorful squares plastered across the building?
So then, by the time the architect is brought in, most of the building's already been figured out. The size, the shape, how it's laid out.
So this is the only way an architect can express
exactly. The architect's job then becomes to put the wrapper on the box. And they try to break up this big box by changing materials or with window placement and size. And so that becomes the design problem.
So when you're designing a building, how does that shape the identity or the culture of a city?
So these design responses do, I think, vary by regions. In the Southwest, you'll see mostly stucco. Fake stucco. In Ann Arbor, there's a sense that the public will be more accepting of a building that's brick. The designs tend to be very staid. In Detroit, Maurice Cox, the director of planning there, has said explicitly that good design is a requirement for development in Detroit. And so he's been bringing in national and international architects. So the design there, I think, is of a higher quality.
In your profession, are there a lot of like focus groups or do you base it on interactions with community members or maybe even your students? How do you know what draws them aesthetically to a building or an area of a city for that matter?
Well, we do have this conversation with my students. What parts of Ann Arbor do you like best? And they're all drawn to Carytown.
For folks who are not from Ann Arbor, okay. What is Carytown?
So it's a very mixed district right adjacent to downtown. It's where the farmers market is. There's lots of commercial uses and retail as well as housing. Much of it is a historic district. So the environment's very diverse and a very small scale. It has a much finer grain than what we see downtown where the buildings are bigger and taller.
And even in the retail center there, it's
it's almost unpredictable when you walk in. You kind of have to negotiate how to get around and what shop to find and things like that.
And this is what makes for an interesting urban environment, is when you have lots of entrances and activities, stoops and porches and shop fronts. So I think one thing cities can do with these larger boxy apartment buildings is to require more entrances, require active uses on the ground floor. Don't let parking be part of the streetscape.
A lot of cities are requiring a retail level, and that doesn't always work if it's not densely populated enough. Why should government get involved in a decision like that, I guess is what I would want to ask.
So many cities, Detroit's looking at this, are using what's called a form-based code. It's a zoning code that specifies the design and not the use. Most zoning codes say it has to be retail. The design form-based code says you have to have entrances, you have to have windows, you have to have stoops or porches, and they can be residential, they can be retail. You can't have parking garages on the street. They have to be underground or behind the building. And so this, I think, is a way to make a better designed, more active and human-scaled environment.
Why in Europe do the buildings all kind of look the same, but people still find them really pleasing, aesthetically pleasing?
In Paris, they're big, boxy, blocky buildings. They all look alike, and no one complains. It's a beautiful urban environment. And I think that goes to the scale of design. So again, these buildings have lots of entrances, active uses on the ground floor, cafes. They also have a design at the level of detail. So the windows are beautifully detailed. The materials are beautifully detailed, very nice materials. They're not fake stucco. You know, they were built in an era when building construction was much different and was a much bigger investment.
We talked a little earlier with the other guest about this shift from concrete block structures to wood structures. Are there any concerns? Do you have any concerns in using this material?
No. And again, that also comes from building codes. The most affordable way to build a building is with lightweight stick construction. So it's a way to keep building costs down.
Is this apartment building aesthetic that we're seeing right now, again, with these big colorful squares, that's not the only thing they do, but that's the one we see a lot around here. Is this going to be one of those 10-year trends, or will those big colorful squares on apartment buildings stick around for a while longer?
I don't think the need for apartments is going to go away. I do think there's innovation in construction methods. So we're going to see more fabricated, manufactured building components. I think this will change the aesthetics of buildings in the future.
So what do you think of this trend? I mean, do you like it? Do your students like it?
I would say the design is uninspired and
Uninspired.
Yeah,
you said.
And I actually teach a design studio where I try to push the students to break out of the formula, to push the formula within the existing constraints of finance and building codes, but to come up with a better response. But it's difficult. It really is the most efficient way to provide housing in our downtowns. And I would say, for the most part, that is a good thing. We have more people living in downtown Ann Arbor. This is good. We have more people who are living close to our major job centers so they can walk to work. We have more people supporting retail downtown. We need to provide more housing, and we need to provide apartments, because most of the population now are young singles or empty nesters. And so we need housing for that demographic. And this is a way to provide it.
Kit McCullough is a lecturer at the Taubman College of Architecture and Urban Planning at the University of Michigan. Thanks for stopping by.
Thank you.
Little boxes on the hillside. Little boxes made of ticky-tacky. Little boxes on the hillside. Little boxes all the same. There's a pink one and a green one and a blue one and a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky and they all look just the same.
We always want to know what you think. What stories are you focused on? What issues do you want to hear more about on Stateside? Well, let us know. Find us on Facebook. Search for Michigan Radio. We're also on Twitter, at Stateside Radio, and michiganradio.org. Just click on the link that says Stateside.
Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, April Van Buren, Laura Weber Davis, and Mercedes Mejia. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. That's our show for today. I'm Lester Graham. Have a great weekend.
And the boys go into business and marry and raise a family in boxes made of ticky-tacky, and they all look just the same. There's a pink one and a green one and a blue one and a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky, and they all look just the same.